Blog Talk Radio.
Those that listen to the show, MPI New York, And we might be migrating. I don't know yet. I have to discuss this with one other person. And if we do, I'll certainly announce it. I'm still a little unclear as to what I want to do. We already have another platform. We haven't used it, however, and we don't know how smoothly. You know, because when you transition, obviously, anything, you want the transition to go smoothly. So I'm not saying that we are going to transition. I'm just saying that we're thinking about it because our, you know, obviously nothing is free and our fees have increased without explanation. We're not happy with that, I have to tell you. That's up in the air, but we will advise you. Those that want to call them, we're live here in the studio, 215-383-3872. Again, that number is 215-383-3872, and you're tuned in again to the Marketing Pulpit International New York edition with yours truly, Dennis D. Shipman on the mic. And so we were talking about the Parkland shooting in Florida, and there seems to be some, I don't know how to say, I'm at a loss for words here. I don't know why I'm not typically at a loss for words. But there seems to be some Republicans, let me put it this way, who may be willing, you know, Rubio and Scott in Florida, to look at some very modest, I don't even know if they're going to make any different modest changes to the gun laws that we have in this country. You know, if you have a felony conviction, you obviously cannot get a gun. But certain guns are so powerful that there's no rational reason for these guns to be on the street. But also, if you have a severe mental disorder or psychiatric disorder, let me put on my my social science and behavioral science hat. You also cannot obtain a weapon. You know, if you've been involuntarily committed, of course they're not going to let you have guns. The other modest restriction that they put on gun restrictions on, you know, restrictions that they put on persons that want to obtain guns is domestic violence, which is a major issue. Down in Maryland, you know, I have several properties. Had a few since shorn myself of one of those properties, but I still have two down there. And so I was down there last weekend, and you know, so I follow the news, the local news, let me put it that way. And it was Prince George's County cop that was killed, you know, intervening in a domestic violence incident. You know, those incidents, according to Pew Research and FBI statistics, are the most dangerous confrontations that a police officer can have, you know, when they're going into domestic, you know, because people, you know, the emotions are high and, you know, people don't believe that, you know, you should be intervening, and then the cops come in and they're like bulls in a china shop, you know, they're taking sides and this thing or that. And what they typically, what most agencies are doing now to ameliorate the danger inherent in domestic violence calls is they're treating them as, you know, as the serious situations that they are, and pulling all persons out of the house at gunpoint in many cases, and separating them. And, you know, perhaps in this particular case, this is what should have happened. The guy was a neighbor, however, and the perpetrator was summarily executed. I have to say that because I watched the footage of it, and I was just thinking about all the white perpetrators of mass violence, you know, the shooting in Vegas, and certainly this last shooting, the Parkland school shooting, and these men were all taken into custody unharmed. you know, to live out their lives in captivity, while this guy, and it's not up to me or to the police to render a judgment on this guy. It was up to the courts, and, you know, I watched the footage of them chasing him across the interstate and shooting at him, and, you know, obviously, you know, he was killed as a consequence. And I'm not saying that I feel sorry for the guy. You know, he killed the cop after all is said and done. But, again, you know, just looking at it from a reasonable perspective, he should have been brought to justice and lived his life out in captivity like all these white guys do. So, that being said, the other part of this equation is that persons, you know, because there was a sheriff here in down in Maryland, Anne Arundel County. The Anne Arundel County Sheriff got in a dispute with his wife and pushed her. She summoned the police, Anne Arundel County cops, and they took him into custody. And he was ordered to surrender his weapon. You know, they know he was the sheriff of Anne Arundel County. So he was, he had to, you know, it was in, you know, the indignity of losing his weapons. And, you know, the case has subsequently been resolved. From what I understand, he's still on the job. I don't know why, but he is, and got his weapons back. I remember that being in a local paper, because I follow those type of things, you know, only because, you know, I look at the disparate treatment that, you know, these people get, you know, whether they get disparate treatment as a consequence of the white privilege being white, or whether they gain disparate treatment as a consequence of being in law enforcement, or well-connected, or just well-heeled. So he had this sheriff down there gotten treatment that would not have been accorded to the average person, you know, embroiled in a domestic violence issue. And this isn't the first cop that has gotten killed, you know, intervening in a, you know, I don't, you know, I remember years ago, and maybe I shouldn't tell that particular story. It had nothing to do with me. It had something to do with someone else that I knew very well, however. You know, I know for a fact, anecdotally, biographically, that, you know, domestic violence situations are not, you know, for anybody, you know, for the victim, the perpetrator, or the cops, whoever's intervening, these are situations that are fraught with peril for everyone. And, you know, we talk a lot about that. I'm a member of a group on Facebook, Black Fathers, because I just, you know, unfortunately went through an issue with my child's mother this morning. Not domestic violence, obviously. We don't live together. But the kind of toxic, immature, vicious ad hominem attacks that she levies at me because she's, you know, misappropriating my child support to pay for the two or three other children that she's had, you know, in the wake of my departure. And that's her business, granted. And I know a lot. I lost a friend, you know, because, you know, when I was still working in you know, full-time, you know, decided not to go out on my own. Before I decided to go out on my own, you know, another social worker, you know, I was working as a social worker for the state of New York. She had, you know, she had the same problems, you know, separated from her daughter's father, and who subsequently passed away. And he was paying her child support. So, you know, I was telling her, from my perspective as a man paying child support, you know, why it's unfair, you know, I don't think it's fair for me to be, why is it not fair? You know, she has household expenses, you should be paying for all that. Why should I be paying for her household expenses? Yeah, I've never understood this. It's ludicrous. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And this fosters a lot of the animus, the antagonism that, you know, many men feel towards the child care system. I mean, you both made that child, and for the court to come in and unilaterally assign one or the other person custody and then make the one person pay for someone else is absurd. And I don't get me wrong now. I don't believe that a man should not pay for his child. I don't believe that. But I believe that there should be some checks and balances on. I don't believe that I should be just writing a check every month for what amounts to thousands of dollars. Well, not thousands, but certainly very, very close to it. And she'd be allowed to, you know, my son comes over, he looks like something out of National Geographic. It's really awful. And, you know, I wind up telling her that I'm going to take pictures, you know, because if you're going to sit up and write me emails that are untrue about how you take him to the barbershop, and if I don't see my son for 3 or 4 weeks, which is not unusual given my personal and professional schedule, he will not get a haircut. It's that simple. And he has hair like mine. It's very coarse. Well, you know, I have very, very coarse hair. And if it's not cut, you know, he looks a mess. There's no other way to parse it. And then, you know, with the runover sneakers and the cheap clothing that the grandmother buys, she doesn't even buy because she's using his money to pay for other children. It's not acceptable. And this stuff, you know, a lot of guys that lack the maturity and wherewithal to deal with this kind of stuff, man, it gets, you know, you could see it, you know, it can escalate. And she's telling me, well, you know, it's not my problem that you live up there and, you know, nobody told you to go back to New York. And, well, first of all, that's not your concern. And I don't want to be anywhere near you. You know, first of all, you know, I don't have the kind of, you know, background professional standing where I can have police contacts where I'm getting arrested for foolishness. Because you're calling the cops after, you know, she's like the type of person, and I don't want to go on and on and on about this, but I just want to share this, that starts a fire and then wants to be the first one out of the building. And, you know, that doesn't sit right with me. And the other part of it is that her older children, when we got involved, she had two older children. One is almost out of school and don't know what this young man is going to do with his life. And that's, he has a daddy, he has paternal and maternal grandparents, so that's their, you know, that's something that they got to deal with internally as a family. But they never look like that. They always had haircuts, always. And she seems to think that I'm quote-unquote self-hating because I want my son to look like a you know, if you're gonna have, and it's not unusual for young men, but my son is only 8 years old. It's not unusual for them to wear their hair, you know, I don't want to say unkempt, but uncombed. But they do have it shaped up, and they just might have the top uncombed. You know, not in dreadlock fashion, just natural, you know, all natural, and just have that little top part uncombed. On some guys, it looks good. On some girls, it looks good. On some girls, it looks bad. On some guys, it looks good. It depends on the person, your face, your features, and that sort of thing. In my kids, in his situation, you know, it doesn't look good. You know, not that he's a cute little kid, but, you know, he, you know, unless you're going to plait it or twist it, he doesn't look good with his hair, just, you know, uncombed. So anyway, enough about that. So, you know, in those situations, you know, you know, where there are obvious and, this is what the judge tried to accuse me of also, let me put that, you know, because I got stopped in Delaware, where my son lives, and the first thing out of the state trooper's mouth was, Mr. Shipman, do you have any weapons in the car? And I said, why would you ask me that? He said it was in the system, you know, because she had told them that I have guns, which I do, but I don't drive around with guns. First of all, I'm not licensed to carry a hand. You know, you don't have to be licensed to have a long gun. But you do have to be licensed to have a handgun. So I was like, no, I don't know. Why would I be carrying, driving around? I'm coming. I believe I was coming from work at the time. And but this is the type of malicious stuff that she had done. You know, but fortunately, the judge had tried to put out an order of protection from abuse on me, and then used it subsequently, which is unlawful, is unethical, to try to justify his own later decision. I mean, this stuff, you know, if I could go to the law and this stuff is really bizarre, but at any rate, I don't want to go to the law because it just really opens up a lot of bad memories. But, you know, you could see where domestic violence, you know, you need to remove weapons out of the equation. I guess that's the part I'm trying to get to. You just need to totally, and in my case, because of my own professional standing, I removed myself from the situation by simply going home, you know, going back to New York in that particular case, so that I'm nowhere near this person except to go down there to grab my kid and, you know, spend a couple of days with him, then I bring him back. So, you know, but it's a tough situation. It really is, because I have no allies in the court system, know that, you know, and so, you know, I'm a big boy. I deal with it like every other man. That, you know, I'm not the first one that has experienced misfortune at the hands of a racist court system, and I won't be the last. So, anyway, let's take a break quickly. Let's talk about black boys.
The Endangered Species Act of 1973 was signed into law by President Richard M. Nixon on December 28, 1973. It was designed to protect critically imperiled species from extinction as a consequence of economic growth and development untempered by adequate concern and conservation. The U.S. Supreme Court found that the plain intent of Congress in enacting the ESA was to halt, reverse the trend towards species extinction, whatever the cause. A species is considered to be endangered if it's in danger of extinction throughout its lifespan or a significant portion of its habitat is threatened, destroyed, or invaded, or if it is likely to become an endangered species within the foreseeable future. Then why are black boys on this list? Black boys are an endangered species. Please go to GoFundMe and to our campaign at /PLZ2MO and contribute generously to help us build an alternative school for these boys that will become a national model for educational innovation. Again, go to GoFundMe and to our campaign at /PLZ2MO.
Marketing Pulpit International, New York edition with yours truly, Dennis Shipman. It's 10:51 a.m. on a cloudy 46-degree Monday morning here in Brooklyn, New York. And we were talking about guns, and I was talking about domestic violence because those are the only three situations, you know, felony conviction, involuntary commitment, you know, for some sort of psychiatric disorder, or domestic violence. Even accusation can get your guns taken. They're trying to put more teeth on that tiger. And I agree with all of that, but I'm on the other side of the debate. I agree with the Second Amendment folk on the fact that I don't think that simply having more laws is going to change anything, because like they argue, you know, the criminal's always going to be. I don't agree with them that everyone should be armed. I just do not. This isn't a Wild Wild West where, you know, everyone could just get guns and they were unregulated, you know, to defend themselves or to do harm to others. I don't agree with that. But I do agree that, you know, we should just be enforcing the laws that are already on the books, and maybe restricting guns that could be easily converted. Because this is the argument, you know, on the news, I was, well, you know, I'm a news junkie, so I was listening to the news and listening to the arguments by the host, the pundits, and their guests, and everybody was missing a point. It's not so much that an AR-15 is more lethal than any other weapon, because there are tons, just like, you know, most of the proponents were arguing, that have the ability to fire multiple times. They really do. But I think if we restrict the ability to convert these weapons to fully automatic, or restrict the sales of restrict the sales to collectors, you know, let's put it that way. You know, because let's be honest, I don't care what anyone says. I don't know anyone that hunts with an AR-15. I do not. And do I know a lot of hunters? Yes, I do. You know, my grandfather hunted, and I know tons of. I've been hunting since I was a child. I have not done it as much since gaining majority, you know, becoming an adult. But and if I do, I use a crossbow. I just prefer it for a lot of reasons. It's more sport involved, and that's part of the reason for hunting. For, you know, you hunt for food and killing animals. They think that's cruel. If I hunt something, you could be sure that I'm going to consume it. That's why I'm careful about what I hunt, because I'm not going to eat everything in the forest, you know. So that being said, you know, I think that there should be some real common sense restrictions on who has what, when, where, how, and why. And Charles Blow in the New York Times today, this morning, has a good piece on guns, and I urge you to read it. You know, Blow is all right. I mean, there are other black pundits, black columnists that I liked a lot better that aren't around any longer for whatever reason. I don't know why. Because it would seem that, you know, writing a column isn't at all, you know, isn't all that taxing. And we need to hear their voices, and we don't, unfortunately. And a lot of them bring it on themselves. You know, there are some that are down at Morgan State. There were some that were down at Hampton in their journalism school. And they absolutely don't write you back. There's one that, you know, because they're elitists, I guess. I don't know. I talked to one, a couple. But the guy that I really wanted to speak to, he's still around. You know, his parents live old, and he's old. But, you know, I wanted, you know, he wrote a book about Martin Luther King. Actually, he was the only reporter on the scene of the Martin Luther King assassination. Name is all Earl Caldwell. He wrote for everybody and their mother. He was with the New York Times for years, the New York Daily News for years. He started out in Clearfield, Pennsylvania, and I love this guy. But I don't know what happened. I was trying to get him on the air. But we just could not ever connect. But I want to get his perspective about all of these issues. And, you know, I'm going to reach out to another journalist that I know that I do have a relationship with that's equally, if not more so, well-known than Mr. Caldwell, and see if I can reach out to him again. But that's about it. For this edition of Mark and Pulpit International, New York edition with yours truly, Dennis Shipman. If we do decide to make a transition, we certainly let you know, but we haven't made any decisions yet. So you just have a great week, and stay safe.
No coincidence, we paid for education.